When the church began in Acts 2 on Pentecost, it began without any officers as we think of them today, unless we would think of the apostles as being officers in the church. They had been a company of men who had been with Jesus from almost the beginning, though they hadn't served in the way the word apostle implies from the beginning. But when he had gone aside from the disciples and had prayed all night, he came back and chose 12 men to be especially close to him and to help him. These men have come to be called apostles. The word literally means to send forth, or one sent forth. The next time we read of anyone, or the first time we read of anyone really in the church beside the apostles, who would be counted as officers in the church, is in the closing paragraph of Acts 11th chapter. Paul and Barnabas have made up a contribution with the help of many in the area of Antioch, about 300 miles north of Jerusalem, which is to be sent down to Jerusalem to help because of a famine in that area, and they carried it to the elders. It was sent to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. That's the first mention of elders, and deacons are not mentioned until we get into the epistles. In Philippians 1:1, Paul addresses the bishops and deacons of the church at Philippi. It's possible that in Acts 6, when some men were chosen to help in the ministration of food on a daily basis, these men were deacons. I think it very likely they were, but we'll come back to that a little later. The title itself is not used there, and it comes to be used in an official sense, first in Philippians 1, again in 1 Timothy 3rd chapter, where they're described at some length, as you've heard this morning. In 1 Timothy 3, there is a rank difference implied, though I think we've made a great deal more of it than 1 Timothy 3rd chapter did. That is, we've attached a great deal more importance to the work of the elders than to the work of deacons. It's true that in this chapter, the two are set in antithesis to one another. The elders are in a governing role. The deacons are in a serving role. And yet, importance of these two is something we've established in our own mind, for the one is needed as badly as the other is needed. It's simply that they are two different functions in nature. God has ordained that a certain class of men be chosen to lead and govern and oversee, and that another class of men be chosen to serve, to carry out special ministrations or activities that they are assigned. The rank or the importance then may largely be in our minds, and yet there is a distinction in the office, the work given. It's certainly clear in this passage that by this time, Paul isn't talking about a group of men just voluntarily serving in a special way whenever they see some need. He's talking about a group of officers in the church. That is, men who've been appointed to a special task of carrying out whatever duties are assigned to them. Actually, the duties are not spelled out. There's no indication of what they were supposed to do in the passage itself. The emphasis is on their character, the quality of the men who are chosen. What they're to do is implied by their very title. They are deacons or servants. The word deacon, the noun translated deacon, is used about 30 times in the New Testament. But it's used only about 5 of those times in the official sense. That is, to refer to an officer in the church. The rest of the time, it may refer to someone very different from an officer in the church. We'll come back to this in a few moments when we look more carefully at the word. But even a magistrate is called a minister of God or a deacon of God in Romans 13:4, just isn't translated by the word deacon in our English translation, so we miss it. But only about 5 times is the word used in its official sense. It's a special word for serve. And I realize that any time one begins to repeat Greek words when they haven't been gone through carefully, or when people haven't studied Greek, it's apt to be a waste of our time. It may even be worse, maybe tedious or boring. And yet, there are several words for serve in the New Testament, and a special one is chosen for the deacon. There's a word, douloo, that you may have heard someone repeat, doulos, which means a slave. The special meaning of this word is subjection to a master. There's another word, therapeuo, and we have a word very similar to it, therapeutic. And it implies the willingness of a man to serve, the kind of concern he has in serving. And usually when we talk about something therapeutic, we imply there's a concern for the health of the person. Another word used in the New Testament is liturgeo, and we have a word in modern times, liturgy, that comes directly from that word. This word was public service to the people or to the state. But the word for deacon, diaconeo, it sounds almost like deacon in English, is a word which has a special shade of meaning, the personal service a man renders. The word comes close to implying the love he's supposed to have in his heart as he renders the service. So he's not just a slave in subjection. He's not just a concerned man helping other people. He isn't just a man who's given to public service. He's a man who serves personally. He's a man who has love in his heart as he serves. This is the implication of the word. There's a background for the word. As in many cases, the word is used in a literal sense in the Greek language a long time before it had a figurative meaning. Obviously, when we talk about a man being a deacon today, we have something of a figurative meaning in mind. Originally, the word appears to have meant something like a floor sweeper, but we do not ordinarily call on deacons to sweep floors today. Or the first meaning it has in Greek literature that we can be absolutely sure of is to wait at table, or to serve as a waiter at a table. And we hardly ever call on deacons to do this kind of work. But from this kind of service, we have taken a figurative meaning, namely to serve the needs of others. And it has something of the original literal meaning left in it, the same kind of task one performs when he serves at a table. He can do in other ways, even when people do not need to be served at table. The first use we have of the word in Greek prose literature is in the writings of Herodotus, a Greek historian, and it means there to be a waiter at a table. The ordinary use of it in that literature outside the New Testament is that a man is a slave or a servant in another man's household. He's rendering a personal service to his master. Sometimes he was a messenger to go down the marketplace and buy. Other times he was a messenger or a servant around the table. The common use outside the New Testament is of a man waiting on the table, serving his master in the home. It was not an honorable task to the Greeks. You may know enough of the Greek mind to know that anybody who was a servant of somebody else had a very low rank in their thinking. Their idea was that man's need, his end, is to develop individual human personality. And they would say, how can a man be happy when he has to serve another man? Service was not something the Greeks admired. It was for the lower classes of people to do, and anyone who engaged in it was looked down upon. The Jews had a bit different idea of service, particularly to the Jews, even in the Old Testament. If a man has a good master, there's nothing wrong with the work of being a slave or a servant. There's nothing dishonorable or low about being a servant if one is treated well in this service. Particularly is this true if he's serving God. If he can think of himself as a servant or a slave of God, then it's an honorable thing rather than a dishonorable thing. One of the things that made the Jews feel differently from the Greeks at this point is a command in Leviticus 19, verse 18, that we know best from Jesus' repetition of it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. If one comes to love his neighbor as himself, then service can be a part of that loving his neighbor. And there's nothing dishonorable about doing it. But we're especially interested not just in the Greek background or in the way the Jews thought of being a servant, but in the New Testament teaching about the word servant. Early in the New Testament, that is in the Gospels themselves, the word is often used in its original meaning, that is to wait on tables. You may recall near the end of Jesus' life, John records in his Gospel, chapter 12, that Jesus went to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom he'd raised from the dead. They prepared a supper for him, John says, and Martha served. It isn't the same instance as when he visited the home in Luke 10, and Martha was serving and Mary was listening, but it's the same home. And the word for serve here is the verb from which we get our noun deacon. She was serving at table. In Luke 17, Jesus told a parable about a man who has a servant The servant has been out plowing all day, Jesus said, or keeping the sheep. When he comes into the house, will the man not say, Jesus asked, gird yourself and serve me my supper, and then the servant may have his own meal? Jesus is illustrating the fact that even though the man has been out at work all day, the master is not going to gird himself and serve the slave when he comes in. The slave is going to have to continue to render his personal service, and after his master's needs are met, he can rest. In doing this, Jesus is showing his own idea of service because he has come as master and is willing to serve. But he also illustrates for us the meaning of the word we talked about. Here's a man who serves at table, who waits on every need of the master. Jesus broadened the word beyond that. In Matthew 25, verses 42 through 44, when he was talking about the final judgment, he pictured people being turned away, you recall, because they hadn't visited prison or visited someone in prison. They hadn't given anything to the naked or the hungry or the sick or the thirsty. They had not exercised hospitality. And he says, because in the least of these things, you did not minister to me, you're turned away. Or they ask, using the word, when did we see thee naked or sick or in prison and did not minister unto thee? The word minister is our word from which we get deacon. So it's a wide word, meaning service of every sort. In John 12, 25, Jesus said, if any man serve me, him will my Father honor. He's now commanding service of everybody else. Indeed, it was Jesus who turned upside down the values of men. I mentioned the Greek point of view that a man can't be happy when he's serving somebody else. Jesus took exactly the opposite point of view. You'll recall his saying, repeated in three of the Gospels. It's in Matthew 20, 28. The Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many. The word to minister is our word to serve. With this background then for service, what are the special qualifications of the man who is going to give himself in service? If we'd read the entire first 13 verses of 1 Timothy 3rd chapter, we would have noticed a contrast between elders and deacons. For example, there's nothing said about the elders not being talebearers or double-tongued, not specifically. And yet the deacons and the women who are referred to alongside them are forbidden to be talebearers or double-tongued. Why? The most obvious reason is that elders in their work of overseeing may not have the same kind of regular contact in every home that the deacons have as they carry about the needs of the various families. The deacons are going from house to house supplying needs that exist. They're in position to gain information about families. Now, if they take this and pass it on to other people, the church is in an uproar. So the deacons are not to be double-tongued. They're not to be tale-bearers. They're not picking up gossip to carry from one house to the other. On the other hand, there are certain qualifications of elders that are not mentioned for the deacons. The elders are to be free and cheerful in their hospitality. They are to be of good report among those on the outside of the church, and they're to have a capacity for teaching. Neither of these is commanded of the deacons. Why not? Apparently because the deacons had no more responsibility in hospitality than any other Christian. That wasn't their special work. But elders, as leaders in the church, would see those missionaries traveling from point to point and had to be especially hospitable. The deacons were not to be men of bad reputation, but their work didn't place them in a conspicuous position of being looked at by all the outside world as leaders in the church in the same way that the work of elders did. So Paul doesn't call special attention to their being of good report of outsiders. A capacity to teach is a work of an elder, implies a work of an elder. It doesn't imply a special task of the deacon. Now you may think of another difference between the two, namely their family obligations, but one learns that from Titus 1, where it is said that the children should be believing children of the elder. In Timothy, the qualification of the elder and of the deacon are in virtually the same words when it comes to their family relationships. So the deacon is to have a well-trained family, just as the elder is, but he doesn't have the same responsibility in hospitality and teaching or in establishing a reputation on the outside of the church that the elder does. Now, the special qualifications in a positive way of deacons, I'm reading from the Revised Standard Version. If you're following in another translation, this will explain some difference. Deacons likewise must be serious. This word does not imply that the man is gloomy or sad or that he has lost all zest for life. It does imply that he has a task which involves sobriety, that one chooses a man to be a deacon in terms of his overall deportment in life. And if he doesn't have this serious quality, he wouldn't be the kind of man who would be chosen. Not double-tongued, Moffat's translation renders this, no tale-bearer. Double-tongued literally means to talk out of both sides of one's mouth, to tell one person one thing and someone else something else. The deacon can't be that kind of man. But further, he's not to be the kind of man, as I mentioned a while ago, who will report incidents from one family to another when they were told in confidence. He's not the kind of man who will use as an illustration in a public speech, for example, something he's learned about a family among his hearers that is not the property or the knowledge of other families among his hearers. There's a special responsibility to guard the information he gains as he serves among the people, not double-tongued, not addicted to much wine. Without going into the fact that most of the water in Palestine was impure, and that the juice of the grape formed a great deal of the beverage of the day, or without going into the inferior means of preserving it without some fermentation taking place, and a contrast between that and what is made in the wineries of our time, Paul clearly says that this man cannot be given, he cannot be addicted to much wine. If he's the kind of man who goes from place to place imbibing a bit here and there, he's going to be the kind of man who will be loose-tongued, to say the least. We face the special problem in our own time that we don't have information about from their time, of alcoholism, where it's impossible to tell in advance the kind of personality who may be open to being addicted to alcoholic beverage. The deacon would have to be especially careful because of this factor. If one could know in advance, it might be another matter, but one can't know in advance. And so he sets an example with reference to alcoholic beverages. Next, he is not greedy for gain. Not greedy for gain implies that the man can't be, as some translations render it, a money grubber. He is handling funds of the church. He is carrying what has been given into the treasury to help some needy family in many instances. Or he's doing some other task that implies use of the funds of the church. If he's greedy for money, he may lay hand on some of this. I don't really think Paul had in mind the danger of his being a shoplifter or a petty thief, so much as the fact that this man has to have an attitude toward gain, toward money. He's not greedy for it. He may realize its importance, he's often using it, but he's not greedy for it. This means that he won't use any dishonest means of getting it, that he'll not try in some way to charge more for services rendered than they're worth or to pay less for services given him than they're worth. He won't be the kind of man who takes advantage of others in financial matters. He's not greedy of gain. And let him hold the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. The mystery of the faith may imply more than we're going to make of it, but I take it to mean simply that there's something very deep about the faith of God, and that this man holds it with a clear conscience. He renders external service all through his life, but the faith that motivates that service is not external. It's interior. He holds the mystery of the faith in a clear conscience. Let these also be tested first, and if they prove themselves blameless, let them serve as deacons. They are men who've been proved already by certain tasks they performed in the church, by a kind of life they've lived in the church. These are the men that are chosen. One doesn't choose a person to be a servant who's never shown any knack for service, or who's never shown any quality of life that would cause him to be chosen. A bit later, Paul says, let deacons be married only once, and let them manage their children, their households well. Married only once has been disputed virtually ever since Paul wrote it. At least for centuries it has. Some have taken it to mean that he can't have concubines, as certain Old Testament characters did. Others that he can't be a polygamist. He can't be married to several women, as men commonly were in that time, in at least part of the world. That he can't be, in other cases, a digamist. That is, he can't be married to two women. And that's been taken to the extreme of saying that even if his first wife dies, he can't be married to a second wife and still serve. Still others take it to mean that if he is divorced and married to another person, he can't serve. And yet others take it to mean that he is to be married once. Married only once implies that he is married once. He's not a single man. And still others take it to mean just very strict morality in marriage. My own understanding of it is that it's both a command and a prohibition. But it does imply his being married because he rears this family. He demonstrates an ability in the home that he uses in the church. And that on the other hand, it forbids any separation from or aberration from God's marriage teaching, which would forbid any kind of relationship in marriage that would be wrong in God's sight. Finally, he says, for those who serve well as deacons gain a good standing for themselves and also great confidence in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. The word standing is sometimes translated degree, a good degree for themselves. And so some have taken it to mean if he serves well as a deacon, he's appointed as an elder. I don't think this is the meaning of the passage. I rather think that being a deacon may bring some honor to the man, but real honor, real influence, moral persuasion over others will come from that good standing that he purchases for himself by serving well as a deacon. Now, we haven't dealt with every problem or question. In Acts 6, 1-6, seven men were chosen to serve. And in the original description, it said that the widows were being overlooked in the daily ministration. And the word is the noun from which deacon comes, another form of it. The apostle said, it's not meet for us to leave the word of God and serve tables. And the word serve is the verb from which deacon comes. So they appointed other men or chose other men to serve tables while the apostles served in the word. And the word serve all the way through is the verb from which deacon comes. So we assume that these men were the first deacons in the church. I think it is a logical assumption. Their qualifications were that they should be of good report, full of the Holy Spirit, and full of wisdom. That was required because of dissension in the church, and it's obvious as to why such qualifications would be set out. Another interesting question that comes partly from the Revised Standard Version, which in Romans 16, 1 and 2 calls Phoebe a deaconess of the church at Cenchrea. The word deacon is used to describe Phoebe in the original language. Question whether that means she's an officer in the church is another question. You may have noted in our text that the women also are to have certain qualifications. Because of this, the question has been raised, are these women who serve in a special way, or are these, as the King James Version says, wives of the officers? I think we'll not be able to settle that one finally. But the arguments in favor of their being officers in the church would emphasize that they're here in a list of officers, likewise the women, just as likewise the deacons. But arguments for their being wives would be based on an interruption in his thought to turn away from the deacon to a deaconess and then back to a deacon, while it would be quite natural if she is his wife who travels around with him in visitation and who also must not be a talebearer or a slanderer. And I would take it that way. The technical word for deacon is not used to describe women in this passage. As for its description of Phoebe, it's used to describe magistrates in Romans 13, 4. It's used to describe Stephanus in 1 Corinthians 16, 15, who'd opened his house with hospitality, with no implication in either case that these are officers in the church. So the deacon is a man who serves. We've really talked about his character, the kind of man he's to be. The only thing we've said about his duty is what comes out of the word. And I think it best to leave it there. After all, the deacon is not a man who takes care of secular jobs so the elders can do spiritual jobs. His work is quite spiritual in its nature too. He's not a junior elder as if he's at a lower level but doing virtually the same thing the elder is doing. His is a different kind of work. He's not just in the training school to become an elder. His is a special task, and the best word for it is to serve. He's an assistant, as Goodspeed translates it. He's a man who carries out special tasks that are assigned by the elders. So as the elders lead in their need for assistance in carrying out work, the deacons are there to serve. The glory of the task of serving is something, as I've said, that Jesus made men aware of. When men were afraid of service because it was lowly and unworthy, it was Jesus who would gird about himself a towel, take a basin of water, and wash his disciples' feet. And through that life of service, he taught us, if I, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. If I've given myself in service, you also ought to give yourself in service. Have you begun that life of service? Would you, by obeying his will, while we stand to sing?
Strong and brave, yet free from